A Wednesday evening Lenten sermon preached by Reverend Richard A. Ram at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan on March 20, 2002 in the series The Grace to Let Go, entitled Of Violence. The texts for the sermon are John 11, verses 45 to 53, and John 12, verses 36 to 43. Copyright, Grand Valley State University. Please note that the original recording spanned two sides of a cassette tape, so there is some missing material. I will bridge the gap.
The grace to let go in a variety of human experiences. The grace to let go as death approaches. The grace to let a child go who's taken wings and fly. The grace to need not to win. The grace to move beyond that begrudging obedience and resentment. Tonight, the grace to let go of control and domination. Control and domination. The desire to run the world, if not simply our own, the larger world, the world at large. The grace, the gift, the growing wisdom, and perhaps the mellowing, which enables us to live more with an open hand than with a clenched fist. And my victim tonight, the focus of my attention, is Caiaphas, the high priest at the time of Jesus' trial and crucifixion. Caiaphas, one of the rulers of the Jewish people, a Sadducee, member of the high priestly family. The Sadducees were that group within the Jewish community that worked in collaboration with the Roman occupier, and in their collaboration they managed to maintain some kind of order in Jewish society, and at the same time became, of course, the beneficiaries of certain privilege. Collaborators are not often well liked by the people, but they have a certain savvy about them, a certain worldly wisdom that enables them to get along and take care of things, keep some kind of order, and come out doing quite well for themselves. Thank you very much. Caiaphas was one of those people. And in the story in John's Gospel, we have Caiaphas with his wily wisdom setting about the machinery to bring Jesus to crucifixion in order, as he says, to save the holy place, the temple, and the nation. And this evening I want to think about that, make that the jumping off point, at least, for a consideration of that tension within our lives always, between the need to control and to dominate and the wisdom to let go and allow the newness to happen. And as we think about that, I'll be thinking primarily in the larger corporate scene, in our institutional life, the life we share together. But certainly it has implications as well for the way we live our lives personally and individually. But in our institutional life, Those who are leaders always have to struggle with that tension between holding on, controlling, dominating, maintaining the status quo, preserving the institution, and perpetuating that which has been the heritage of the past and has been positive and beneficial, over against that openness to that which is new, to fresh insight and new ideas that could transform the institution and cause the tradition, rather than being stultified, to be a living and growing tradition. And what I'm talking about tonight is not a simple matter. It's very complex. Indeed, I think I've really mastered this thing because I can argue it on either side with about equal persuasiveness. It's not easy. Just take Caiaphas. First of all, let me say, the Gospel of John arose in a conflict situation. We know that. It was probably in the 90s of the first century. And the tension between the Jesus movement and the Pharisaical, rabbinical, Jewish movement was at its height. And we know today from what has come to light about the cultural situation, the context of that time, that the Jesus movement was really making a significant bid to become the ongoing expression of Israel. It is not inconceivable that there never would have been a split between Judaism and the Christian church, and that which Jesus represented as a Jew, as a part of that tradition, that tradition, Allah Jesus, could have become the ongoing expression of Israel. And as a matter of fact, it did not. The Pharisaic rabbinical party or movement came to the ascendancy. And consequently, there is an ongoing people of Israel to this day. The Pharisaic rabbinic movement centered on the Torah. The priesthood was gone. The temple was destroyed. All they had left was the book. The rabbinical movement was a study of the Torah, and it formed the framework for an ongoing Jewish people, even in this dispersion around the world. But again, the Gospel of John was written at a time when the conflict between those two Jewish movements was sharp. Now understand, this isn't anti-Semitism at this point. This is intra-Jewish conflict. Which movement will provide the future for the people of Israel? So Caiaphas, as the leader of the Sadducean party, and as the one who had interest in the ongoing tradition of Israel as Israel, was representative of the established and the given institutional structures in life. And when he says, if we do not do something about this enthusiasm that is bubbling up in the wake of Jesus' raising of Lazarus from the dead, then the Romans will get very, very edgy and very nervous, and they'll come in and they'll destroy this place and they'll destroy our nation. He didn't make that up. He was well aware. He was a collaborator. He knew about how far things could go within Jewish life before the Roman occupier would come in and snuff it out. And he was well aware of the fact that it wasn't only Jesus, but there was a zealot party that were with cloak and dagger trying to, by guerrilla warfare means, undercut the Roman occupier. There were always those firebrands that were breathing revolution, as ridiculous as that must have seemed in the light of Roman power. So you got to give Caiaphas credit. You have to recognize that John is a slanted story because it's written from the perspective of the Jesus movement over against that which was the greatest competitor for its ascendancy. And if John isn't read that way, it can be read with an anti-Semitic bias, which isn't in there, but which can feed that kind of anti-Semitism. But that being said, Caiaphas nonetheless is a representative of institutional continuity. And not only institutional continuity, but that desire to control and to dominate that cuts off the possibility that newness can happen. You know, I've sat here for a long time. It's tragic that there should have been a split between Judaism and another world religion spawned. I don't think Jesus ever conceived that or intended that, and would have been grieved by it, I believe. Even though, paradoxically, because of that split and the Christian movement, the God of Israel was brought to the nations. So how do you figure? In the olden days, I would have said, see the providence of God. It works every time. And maybe so. Who knows? But my point tonight, the focus tonight, is that struggle in a Caiaphas. The tension in a Caiaphas. And his decision, finally, to maintain the status quo.
Notice, there is no question about whether or not what Jesus is teaching and preaching threatened Rome's imperial power that depended on force of arms to maintain order in society. A prophetic voice such as Jesus upsets the comfortable status quo. A Caiaphas is responsible to maintain society's peace. And that is his dilemma. Will his sense of Jesus' truth determine his action? Or will it be fear or cowardice?
I'm sure we're all grieved at the tragedy within the Roman Catholic Church today. What a tragedy that is. And I love the Roman Church, and I'm glad the Roman Church is there, and I hope the Roman Church will always be there. So this is not a Protestant saying, yeah. But the hierarchy kept silent when they should not have kept silent. And they would have had a very strong argument and rationalization for keeping silent. So the faithful do not have their faith and devotion disturbed, huh? But then there's a deeper issue that the Roman Church has to deal with, and that is the unrealistic dealing with human sexuality. A church that cannot accept what we know today about sexual orientation, continuing its condemnation thereof, and yet fully aware that a high percentage of the priesthood are gay men. Who will speak up? Who will say it? When the people know it. These are the tensions, huh? Or, if we look at the nation, are we not all aware, are we not acutely aware today of the tension with which our nation has to go into the future. In this crisis time, I read a piece from Thomas Friedman, whose pieces I always respect, in the New York Times, entitled A Foul Wind. He said, there is something about this new intensely violent stage of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict that is starting to feel like the fuse for a much larger war of civilizations. Some of us studied Samuel Huntington's book some months ago about this civilizational dimension and its and the possibility of war, civilizational wars. And Thomas Friedman, who's had a lot of experience in the Middle East, says, I have never felt the anti-Israeli and anti-American sentiments that I feel now. And he said, the question is whether Palestinian extremists will do what bin Laden could not do, trigger a civilizational war. If you're willing to give up your own life and that of thousands of your people, the overwhelming power of America and Israel does not deter you anymore. And he tells about a visiting Egyptian official who spoke about a time he was addressing some students about Middle East peace, who was interrupted by one of the students to say, eight small suitcase-sized nuclear bombs, the whole problem of Israel could be eliminated. And I had just read another article in a recent New York Times magazine about how to fight the next war. And it goes right along with what we're talking about tonight, the military. Talk about control and domination. And the president came in to speak about transformation of the military in order that it might be more agile and more adept at doing what has to be done in our day. And the Defense Department and the Pentagon steering them down. And then the article went on to say, after 9/11, virtually every military defense system that's been in the hopper is going along full force, not being called in question anymore, even though those who study these things know that it's outmoded. But that whole institutional thing gets so intertangled. And then this article quoted a 1989 article by four military men and a man named William Lind, who talked about four stages of military action. Columns of men against columns of men, and then artillery blasting each other, and then the Germans pioneered the Blitzkrieg, the maneuvering, fast movement kind of thing. The fourth, in 1989, was described precisely what happened by the Al-Qaeda. That some stateless cultural group like the Islamic community, without a lot of means, would infiltrate the West, use its technology, and wreak devastation. Now, you know, when you read that, then you say, so there were those that long ago. Remember 1989, the Berlin Wall came down. There was a kind of euphoria. There seemed to be new possibilities. And there were those who were saying, you know what? The big ideological battle has been won. And now, the threat will be exactly what happened on 9/11. But rather than working on the kind of intelligence that could rule off 9/11 and addressing the hate and the resentment of the rest of the world against us, We've continued to build the arsenal, and well, if some have their way, a missile defense shield. Well, some little student in Egypt is saying, you know what? 8 suitcase-sized bombs could eliminate the problem of Israel. What has all this to do with Caiaphas? It's the human problem. The need to control and dominate. And when we are in the place of power, the refusal to relinquish our power or our grip, and the refusal to allow fresh ideas and new insights to alter rigidly held positions. Caiaphas, he could have given you a good rationalization for the fact that Jesus had to die. In that same New York Times Magazine article, William Lind, who in 1989 prophesied the next event, which actually happened in 9/11. He was asked after 9/11, what do we do now? He said, within 2 weeks, we should have bombed Afghanistan off the map with nuclear weapons. I worry about military advisors like that. Thomas Friedman concludes his little piece by saying, if we don't address the underlying problem, it will simply be total slaughter, and it will be the end of Israel. If we don't address the anger and the resentment, whether it is justified or not, if we don't address the despair and the hopelessness and the helplessness, if we don't deal with the underlying problem of the human situation, we finally will lose control. And there will be no domination except the chaos of a human story brought to anguish. Well, we've talked about the church, we've talked about the nation, and I think it's important for us to think about these things because we are the people on the street after all. And our attitudes are important, the people that we meet. But I wouldn't want to leave tonight without saying that this has implications for the way we live our lives too. With our little ways, our little systems, and our little structures. One of the advantages of growing old is that you do begin to see that all of those ideas and truths and commitments with which you were so passionately marked throughout your life, you get to see that, oh my goodness, there's another way to look at that. Shedding some absolutisms, mellowing out a little bit, learning to live with an open hand rather than a clenched fist, not needing to control the world or the people immediately around us, being able to shift a bit, move a bit, getting a bit loose, a little bit irresponsible maybe. Just lightening up a bit. and letting life happen and moving with the flow of it with grace and with good humor. Dear God, that's a lot happier way to live. I recommend it.